This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. I want to welcome you to the environment edition of Trumpet Hour. Three stories today and a last word that are a little outside our usual offerings: food production, farming, and global warming. First, we'll have a conversation with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about the U.S. agricultural giant Monsanto. It was recently purchased by a German company. Now, you need to understand what this company does and how dependent on it Americans have become for our food production, and just how problematic it is that we would allow it to be controlled by a foreign entity. Then we'll hear about another problem facing American farmers: racism. Racism that is against white farmers. That certainly is what appears to be happening, as Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa will explain to us, regarding a policy implemented by the Biden administration. At least that is the contention of a group of white farmers who are suing the Biden administration for how it is discriminating against them. Then a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some deceptive practices by the Environmental Protection Agency manipulating data to fit their global warming narrative. And I'll finish today's program by telling you the story of a man who turned an industrial disaster area into a flourishing forest. Let's start with this story about Monsanto now being owned by the Germans. To talk about this, we have here in the studio our man on staff who watches all things Germany, Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Elika.
So tell us about this this procurement of an American company. This American company, a huge, huge company, this German company bought it at a financial loss. Explain that to us.
Yes, I think everyone is familiar with the name Monsanto. It's the U.S.'s largest seed producer, what used to be till the German company Bayer took it over. It was actually quite a process in 2016 when Monsanto didn't want to be purchased or being taken over by the German company, and took quite a few bidding processes till they finally agreed to a $66 million takeover. And at the time, the crop and the production, the farmer said, it was declining. It wasn't as profitable at the moment anymore. So there were some scenarios where they could see that this is going to be a bad financial decision. And there were also a few law cases that were filed against Monsanto at the time already. So it was quite a danger for Bayer to take over Monsanto. But nonetheless, they urgently wanted to take it over and kept bidding till they got it.
So let's talk about Monsanto for a bit. This company really has a reach into Americans' lives in a lot of ways that people are probably unfamiliar with. Just tell us what this company does and how it influences us in ways that we don't know.
Yes, every farmer probably could tell you his own story about Monsanto, but reality is that only very few of us are farmers anymore, and the farmlands are growing and growing and growing. And that's the reason why Monsanto exists. Monsanto is a large seed producer, so many farmers are dependent on purchasing seed from Monsanto. And Monsanto has one policy where it says that the farmers can't keep seeds for the next harvest from their own plants because they have manipulated the seed to basically make it their own. So buying Monsanto seed means you're dependent on Monsanto seed, and you also have to purchase their pesticides because the Monsanto plants are so designed that they are protected against their pesticides, and the pests are growing so fast that you can't grow anything almost on such a large scale without using pesticides. So they're really in a predicament here that they are, once they are bought from Monsanto, they're reliant on Monsanto, and it's really a financial trap in many ways.
So just to stick to the pesticides point for a bit, you say that the amount of pests that are coming in to invade American crops is increasing. Is this in part because of the manufacture of pesticides, that you have pests that become resistant to that?
Yeah, the way farming works these days, you have large fields with only one sort of plant, and the pests are spreading from one plant to the other. And for years, mankind has tried to fight against that with pesticides, but the pests are developing more and more resilient to them with time, so more pesticides have to be developed to fight against the growing pests, and they just basically try to be one step ahead of the other, but it always never works out perfectly, so there's still large amounts of losses every year.
You wrote an article about this on the Trumpet site, and you cite a Guardian article from last year that talks about the fact that this company knew that the way that they were going about their business model, basically, that it would hurt a lot of U.S. farms, that they found internal documentation to show this. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, that's right. So Monsanto cooperated with another German company, BASF, in producing Dicamba, I believe it was the name of it. And so the way pesticides work is that you spray it over the field and it protects that crop from the pests. But because of wind, water, and other factors, pesticides also spread. So the danger is that the pesticides that are sprayed can also go on the fields of other farmers. And then the crops there might die because of the pesticides, or people might be eating the pesticide through the produce that they are consuming. So Monsanto was aware, but they said that the product they produced wouldn't spread as much, and they basically lied about that fact. That's still now filed in the law cases, and many have gotten cancer from those pesticides, and that's why charges of multiple millions and billions are now filed against Monsanto, which Bayer has to pay for.
Okay, so we've got a pretty good idea of the company Monsanto, and the fact is that they're doing a lot of practices that put a lot of farms at risk, that put a lot of people's lives at risk. They're manipulating the genetic information in the seeds that make our crops. So looking again at this acquisition by this German company, Bayer, explain what kind of problems would result from a foreign company having access to the information and really the powers that Monsanto has.
Yes, due to greed, many people die in the U.S. due to bad farming habits. Many crops are failing us, and harvests fail. But if you imagine that a foreign company has power over the produce of the next harvest, that in turn secures the lives of millions of people, that's quite concerning. So Monsanto basically was responsible for keeping America's farmland going for the next few years, to make sure that Americans have bread on the table, to make sure that Americans are surviving and are even able to export some of their produce. But a foreign company now is in charge of that. If that foreign company decides to not sell seeds, that would be a large problem for American farmers and would cause a large chain reaction that causes people to not be able to grow the next crop, essentially, because they are not allowed to store any seeds due to Monsanto's previous rules. Now imagine if they sell pesticides that do not only kill or fight off the pests, they're actually attacking the plants that they're meant to protect. That would also lead to large-scale failure of the harvest for that year. And now imagine, as it often is, those pesticides are usually designed to be least harmful to people as possible. They're always a little bit harmful, but they try to make them as least harmful as possible. Now, if you change the formula a little bit, they suddenly become much more dangerous to the human population. So a farmer could unknowingly spread them all over his field, his crop could die, or he could feed the poisoned food to millions of Americans.
So this is the type of thing that the average person looks at this and says, Germany would never, ever do that. This element of trust in foreign countries, this is kind of, America does this all the time. It's kind of endemic in the way that America does business with a lot of nations, that we just don't foresee a nation actually turning on America and this potential threat turning to reality. Now, what makes this interesting, we're talking about vulnerabilities that most people are just not aware of. You're kind of connecting the dots and looking at the fact that this German company was willing to buy Monsanto at a loss. Looking at its face, it doesn't make financial sense. There must be some kind of strategic reason why they're interested in making an acquisition like this. But you're looking at it also from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. Maybe you can just give us a sense of the overview of why this is of such concern.
Yes, you're right. So during a wartime, if Bayer would have taken over Monsanto and Germany and US would be at war, people would raise red flags and say, like, no, we can't allow this. But no, people think we are allies, Germany and the US are allies, so they're not so concerned about that takeover. But reality is that many in Germany still see the two nations at war. It was Hitler who said at the very end of World War II that they want to keep fighting, even if they temporarily might lose. And there has been a Nazi underground who also said they want to keep fighting, even if they momentarily have to capitulate. And this company was the very company that rose from IG Farben. And IG Farben was the company that enabled Germany to rise in World War I and in World War II. After World War II, the company went underground again. It split into different branches. One of them was Bayer, one of them was BASF. And both of them are now giants in the chemical industry. Both of them have a global dominance, and both of them are producing large-scale products to enable the German economy. But if you consider that such an economy could easily be turned to being a war economy, you can see how a chemical company could suddenly produce chemical weapons or bioweapons or herbicidal weapons. They have all the expert, they have all the knowledge, they have all the equipment, and they even have a stranglehold over the US with what they are doing recently with Monsanto and other things, where they made inroads in the US. And the Bible prophesies in Deuteronomy 28 that America's harvest will fail. It prophesies that pestilence will spread. It prophesies that millions of Americans will die of starvation. It even has a horrifying image of a young mother which doesn't want to share the birth of her child because it wants to eat that child for herself.
Mm. So the fact that it's Germany specifically that is involved in this transaction is also significant. There are these prophecies that talk about crop failure in the United States, that talk about famine in the United States and in the other nations of modern-day Israel. There are also prophecies that talk about Germany being the aggressor against America.
That's exactly right. We see that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28. It's a nation of fierce countenance. We see a prophecy in Jeremiah that talks about famine and pestilence, and it says it's caused by the Chaldeans. And as Mr. Armstrong explained in his book, The United States and Great Britain in Prophecy, the Chaldeans are modern-day Germany. And we also have a book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, that explains that in more detail, and various other prophecies that relate to this coming famine and pestilence and a siege against America also identify the Assyrians, which are also the ancestors of Germany, as our free literature explains. So we see many, many, many connections to those prophecies and to modern-day Germany as the aggressor And we also see now how a German company took over an American company that is responsible for the next harvest of millions of Americans. So it's easy to see how this company could cause those very prophecies that are so specific and are in so great detail, and it lines up perfectly with what we are seeing right in front of our eyes.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about the implications of the German company Bayer taking over U.S. agriculture giant Monsanto. He's written an article about this subject that is up at thetrumpet.com. The title of that article, Why Did Bayer AG Take Over Monsanto? He's also working on an expanded version of the article for the next print edition of The Trumpet. That is tentatively called When the Harvest Fails. You can watch for that in the coming weeks at thetrumpet.com, where we publish our new print edition once that appears on newsstands. So do keep your eye out for that, and thank you very much for your time, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Is the Biden administration going after white farmers? It has definitely implemented policies that discriminate against them, as we will now hear in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
A group of white farmers from Wisconsin, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Ohio are suing the Biden administration for an out-and-out racist federal loan forgiveness program that applies only to farmers of color. The American Rescue Plan provides $4 billion to farmers as part of the recent COVID-19 relief package. But the United States Department of Agriculture is promising to pay up to 120% of loan balances specifically to socially disadvantaged producers. Now, the USDA writes of those who qualify for this loan forgiveness program saying, quote, any socially disadvantaged borrower with a direct or guaranteed farm loans as well as farm storage facility loans qualifies. The American Rescue Plan Act defines socially disadvantaged as Black, African American, American Indian or Alaskan Native, Hispanic or Latino, and Asian American or Pacific Islander. Gender is not a criteria in and of itself, but of course women are included in these categories. Daniel Lennington of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty summed it up perfectly. He said, if you're not white, you get the benefit. If you're white, you do not get the benefit. Adam Faust, one of the plaintiffs, said he is suing because he sees this program as simply race-based discrimination. It was just out and out racist, he said, and I don't really think that there should be racism allowed in the federal government at any level. If somebody's green, I think they should be allowed to participate based on their actual qualifications for the program and not just picking an arbitrary thing like race. However, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who also served under Barack Obama, argues that this program is simply addressing decades of what he calls systemic racism and discrimination perpetuated against Black farmers. He says that this has prevented numerous African Americans, among other people of color, from fully realizing the same level of prosperity and success as their white counterparts. Proponents of this program point to the declining Black farmer population as evidence of systemic racism in American agriculture. For example, in 1920, there were 949,000 Black farmers, and that number is significantly dropped to just 45,000. But to blame this decline solely on racial discrimination is factually incorrect, because farming as a whole has been on the decline in America. For example, in the same year, 1920, there were about 5.5 million white farmers. Today, that number stands at just 3.2 million, and that's a drop of over 2 million farmers since 1920. About 1.6 million, which amounts to 70% of that drop, has been in just the last 34 years. Things like economic turmoil, weather disasters, shrinking markets have all been hurting farmers of all races. Foreign competition is also eroding American agriculture. Farmers are being forced to sell their land to urban developers. Just over the last 50 years, America has lost 160 million acres of farmland. The result of all these factors is a suicide rate among farmers twice the national average. This debt relief program supposedly exists to respond to the cumulative impacts of systemic discrimination and barriers to access that have created a cycle of debt. But nationwide, farm debt stands at $416 billion, the highest that it's ever been. Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies in the Midwest rose 12% between 2018 and 19, and they rose 50% in the Northwest. Throw in the pandemic and the lockdowns, and an awful situation became even worse. Pretty much all farmers are hurting right now, and for many of them, the pain has been caused by government-imposed lockdowns. So basically, the US government is causing the farmers' hardships, and then it's refusing to help those of just one race. The lawsuit that group of farmers made says this: were plaintiffs eligible for the loan forgiveness benefit, they would have the opportunity to make additional investments in their property, expand their farms, purchase equipment and supplies, and otherwise support their families and local communities. Because plaintiffs are ineligible to even apply for the program solely due to their race, they have been denied the equal protection of the law and therefore suffered harm. Now, these problems facing farming transcend race, and the passing of race-based legislation is something that only creates new problems, and this is something that we've seen before. Zimbabwe, which is a former British colony, launched an aggressive anti-white farmer program in the early 2000s. This program legalized the government's seizure of white-owned farms, and I'm originally from Zimbabwe, and this practice of the government officials waiting until white farmers had collected all their harvests before seizing both the land and the produce, it was common knowledge. It was a very similar situation in neighboring South Africa. In fact, it was probably even more brutal there. Thousands of white farmers have been attacked since 1998, and officially nearly 2,000 people have been murdered. The real number is probably even higher. And the high chance of death makes farming one of the most dangerous professions for white South Africans. Even though the Biden administration's new legislation is still a far cry from what happened in Zimbabwe and South Africa, it could be the start of an increasingly radical anti-white farmer agenda. What happened in those countries is a warning to the United States, particularly when viewed through the lens of Bible prophecy. The Bible details a special relationship between God and the nation of Israel, in which God promises it blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. In the United States and Britain in prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong proved that the modern-day descendants of Israel are the American and British peoples, as well as the Australian, Canadian, Dutch, South Africans, and others. As punishment for forgetting their special relationship with God, these nations were prophesied to suffer severe curses. In our 1997 booklet, South Africa in Prophecy, we wrote, "In their modern decline, due to rebellion against God and their refusal to acknowledge Him as the source of all blessings, we are witnessing the fall of South Africa as a prelude to the accelerating descent of the United States and the once great British Company of Nations. South Africa is the first major domino to fall in what will become a free fall of those once mightiest nations on earth. America is adopting South Africa's style legislation. With rising inflation rates and money printing, it is even adopting Zimbabwe-style economics. The comparisons we made in 1997 between the US and South Africa might have seemed extreme at the time, but both history and prophecy show where these policies are leading. Only by remembering its special relationship with God can America and all other Israelite nations be spared from what's coming. To learn more about this special relationship, please request the United States and Britain in Prophecy.
Thank you very much, Rufaro. So you have some personal experience with this, having seen firsthand what happened in Zimbabwe when these types of policies were enacted. Give us a bit more of the history of what happened there.
Well, essentially what happened is that the white farmers back home were, for the most part, the only active ones, the only productive ones. Their farms essentially provided everything that the Zimbabwean economy needed in order to succeed, and it was very successful. Zimbabwe's economy at one point, I'm quite sure, was on par with New Zealand's, for example, something which would be amazing today for a country in southern Africa. But with the seizure of the white farms, the Zimbabwean economy went into a free fall, and nothing became lucrative. There was no produce anymore. They were taken from them and given to people who didn't have much experience in farming, and it just contributed to the rather precipitous decline of Zimbabwe's economy. And what's really concerning about all this is you look at America, and it's a very similar issue. Farming and agriculture is crucial to the American economy. And when you isolate and ostracize the massive group that contributes to the economy in that way, the vast majority of American farmers are white. And when you decide to pass legislation like this, which places them at a disadvantage, that's directly threatening, you know, the large source of American revenue as far as the economy is concerned. That's very dangerous. And we've seen in Zimbabwe what that does. And again, this is just the start of it, but it could just become so much worse if they continue in the same vein.
Yeah, I mean, this is the specific policy that was enacted in the United States. It was giving loan forgiveness to only farmers of non-white farmers. What happened in Zimbabwe and South Africa was actual farm seizures. So far more draconian, far more far-reaching and serious policies. But the impetus behind them really quite similar, isn't it? It was in Zimbabwe. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the thinking behind that. What was it about white farmers that made them subject to those kinds of impositions?
Well, it was basically the idea that Zimbabweans had been oppressed. The black Zimbabweans had been oppressed by the whites. And the only way to right the wrongs of that oppression would be to take back the land that was rightfully belonging to Zimbabweans. You know, they said that these people came and unlawfully took the land that belongs to us. But the truth of it is that the land wasn't being utilized prior to the arrival of the colonists in the way that they ended up using it, you know. And the irony of it is that after the land was given back to the Zimbabweans, it wasn't utilized in the same way again. It went back right to type. And similarly here, it's the idea of decades of oppression by whites is the reason why blacks have been suffering and other minority groups, and the only way to right that wrong is now to oppress those people who purportedly were oppressing all the other races in order to fix that. But that creates so many more problems than you're trying to solve. You're solving a non-existent problem for that fact. You see that clearly in the stats, the fact that everyone who farms is going through problems.
Right.
It's not by race. It's because of the climate we're living in. It's because of the politics of the world. It's because of other curses that America is going through that we've discussed on the trumpet for decades now. and to minimize it, to say that it's just racism that was causing all those problems for minority farmers is a really misguided view of the entire situation.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about policies implemented by the Biden administration that discriminate against white farmers. He has an article on the subject you can read at thetrumpet.com. The title of that is "The Biden Administration Going After White Farmers." Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Global warming and climate change are accepted as fact, it seems, practically universally. But there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, and it tends to get covered up and ignored. We'll hear about a stunning example of this in this report from Andrew Miller.
As state officials warn that this year could be the worst wildfire season California has ever seen, federal officials are deleting historical wildfire data in an underhanded attempt to connect California's wildfires to global warming. Until just recently, the National Interagency Fire Center maintained statistics going back to 1926 on annual wildfire counts and the number of acres burned in those wildfires. But now, the agency only maintains statistics going back to 1983. Why the sudden change? Well, the answer is simple. According to Anthony Watts in an article for Climate Realism, data prior to 1983 showed U.S. wildfires were far worse 100 years ago, both in frequency and the total acreage burned. By disappearing all data prior to 1983, which just happens to be the lowest point in the data set, federal officials show a positive slope of worsening wildfire alignment with increasing global temperatures. This truncated data set is perfect for claiming climate change is making wildfires worse. Now, the original data showed that in the 1930s, it was not unusual for 50 million acres of U.S. forests to burn down each year. But as states begin clearing away underbrush, thinning out forest, and allowing prescribed burns, the number of acres consumed by wildfires began to decline, until fewer than 10 million acres were burned each year in the 1960s. It was not until misguided environmentalists stopped clearing out the underbrush that fires started becoming a big problem once again. But when you delete the data prior to 1983, no one sees these trends. They just see that for the past 40 years, wildfires have been becoming more common as carbon dioxide levels rise. And they come to the conclusion that they have to support the Biden administration's Green New Deal if they want the fires to stop. And this blatant data manipulation is far from the only example of fraud in the climate change debate. The hypothesis of man-made global warming states that when human beings burn fossil fuels, the resulting carbon dioxide gas insulates the planet to an unnatural extent. This causes the planet to warm and the polar ice caps to melt. While few people deny that the planet seems to be about a degree and a half warmer than it was a century ago, the link between the rising temperatures and rising carbon dioxide levels is not as straightforward as many politicians say. According to NASA's Earth Observatory, Earth's average temperature increased by almost 1 degree Fahrenheit between 1918 and 1941. Over the same period, carbon dioxide levels increased 5%. Then, between 1941 and 1978, carbon dioxide levels increased another 5%. But temperatures decreased by about half a degree. The media at the time engaged in a freakout about global cooling. Yet from 1978 to 1998, temperatures increased another degree. Carbon dioxide levels have risen about 15% since 1978, however, the average global temperature seems to have stopped increasing since 1998. These points cast serious doubt on the notion that burning fossil fuels is the primary cause behind the planet's 1 degree temperature increase over the past century. Scientists from America's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration rushed to publish a paper denying this pause in global warming before world leaders met to sign the Paris Climate Accords in 2015. But Dr. John Bates recently revealed that this agency had to breach its own rules on scientific integrity to get this paper out on time. The agency also failed to archive key pieces of data used in the paper, which means that its conclusions can never be fact-checked or verified. Government-funded scientists are ignoring evidence that global warming does not correlate to carbon dioxide emissions and has paused for much of the past two decades. They are also ignoring evidence that the Earth has experienced higher temperatures than today before carbon-emitting industries were even invented. And by ignoring this evidence, they're able to convince people that natural disasters are caused when people burn fossil fuels, and the only way to stop these natural disasters is to sign the Paris Climate Change Accord, vote for the Green New Deal, and turn control of the entire global economy over to a socialist central planning committee. But none of these solutions will solve California's wildfire crisis, because this crisis is not caused by carbon dioxide. It is caused by a combination of improper forest management practices and the worst drought since the late 1500s. And while the people deleting data at the National Interagency Fire Center would probably like you to think that the abnormally dry conditions in the western United States are a result of man-made global warming, this assessment ignores data showing that droughts used to be far worse before European settlers even came to the New World. An American Meteorological Society report titled 2,000 Years of Drought Variability in the Central United States states, "Historical documents, tree rings, archaeological remains, lake sediments, and geomorphic data make it clear that the droughts of the 20th century, including those of the 1930s and 1950s, were eclipsed several times by droughts earlier in the past 2,000 years, and as recently as the late 16th century. In general, some droughts prior to 1600 appear to be characterized by longer duration and greater spatial extent than those of the 20th century." So it appears that a general greening trend began in North America shortly before the first British colonists arrived in Virginia and has continued until just recently. So the real question is, why is this remarkable period of rain in due season ending? Herbert W. Armstrong proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the United States and Britain are descended from the ancient Israelites. He also described a detailed prophecy in Leviticus 26, where God said he would withhold blessings from Israel for 2,520 years if Israel defied his laws. The Assyrian Empire enslaved the Israelites and carried them away captive in 1718 BC. Count forward 2,525 years from 1718 BC and you arrive at AD 1803, the year President Thomas Jefferson purchased the Louisiana Territory and America started becoming a superpower. This astonishing prophecy helps explain the real reason Great Plains megadroughts ended in the 16th century. God was preparing to bless the descendants of ancient Israel by making America the undisputed breadbasket of the world. And Leviticus 26 also explains why these megadroughts are coming back. God told America's Israelite ancestors that if they disobeyed his laws, then he would punish them. In Leviticus 26, verses 19 through 20, God says, "I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass, and your strength will be spent in vain. For your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the field yield their fruit." These verses reveal a time when the sky will hold as much moisture as a sheet of iron, and the soil will hold as much moisture as a plate of brass. The fact that much of America is suffering from drought is a wake-up call from God, yet U.S. leaders are doing all they can to convince people that drought, storms, and other natural disasters are caused by carbon dioxide. In his article, The Deadly Climate Change Deception, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry writes, "The idea that carbon emissions cause storms is the antithesis of what God says. In Amos 4 and verse 7, God says, 'And I have withholden rain from you, and when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city, and I caused it to rain not upon another city. One piece shall be rained upon, and the piece wherein it rained not withered.'" So here God is controlling the rainfall, causing floods and droughts. Why would he do that? Verse 8 answers, So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Ye have not returned to me, said the Lord. God causes these conditions as punishment for pushing him out of their lives. These are prophecies for the near future. So all the evidence shows that if everyone in America would look to God, the plagues would stop.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You know, it's hard to convey over radio. When you look at just one chart, you look at the chart that you were referencing of the number of wildfires, and you see this huge spike explosion, some decades ago, and then it tapers down, and then you see this little bump over the last 20 years. The fact that they cut the data exactly where everything before it showed much, much higher levels. You can see it just at a glance in a chart. It's hard to convey that. But this is so maddening that you have a government agency that is so blatantly manipulating the data to try to convey the impression that they want to convey. This is just absolutely manipulating facts to serve an agenda.
Right. That National Fire Center thing was, I think, one of the most blatant examples of data manipulation I've ever seen. Because, like I said, when you if you could see the chart, I mean, it's literally the story of the last 100 years is how drastically wildfires have declined since the 1930s. There's like a tenth as many between the 1930s and the 1960s, and then they cut it off right at 1983, which was the lowest year in the entire data set, just to really make the point that you're like, okay, well, since they've stopped doing these forest management practices, they're getting worse. Mm-hmm. And it's not the only example. That was from the National Interagency Fire Center. But the EPA last week did a similar thing where they have a climate tracker. The web page is titled Climate Change Indicators High and Low Temperatures. And they used to have a page on there showing U.S. heat wave index from 1895 to 2015. And that page, if you looked at it, showed that there was a huge temperature spike in the 1930s, right when the Dust Bowl happened. It makes sense. There was the Dust Bowl. I mean, you had all this farmland in Oklahoma and Texas and the central United States where the topsoil basically dried up and blew away due to a combination of bad farming practices where you didn't have plant cover to hold the soil on the ground, but then also just this huge drought and heat wave, which that kind of similar to the fire thing threw a monkey wrench in your carbon dioxide causes global warming narrative when you saw that, like, okay, well, as bad as it is now, it was at least in terms of temperature really bad in the 1930s as well, even worse than the 1930s. And so they completely deleted that page. And I guess unlike the fire agency, they didn't just delete it and replace it with nothing. They actually replaced it with a new graph that does show a temperature spike in the 1930s, but shows it far less extreme and more akin to what you're seeing today. So that might not be as dramatic an example of data manipulation, because what the fire agency did, there's just absolutely no way to defend that. You just deleted the data you didn't like and got rid of it. Mm. What the APA did, it's like, okay, well, you took one data set, deleted it, and replaced it with another data set. And I'm sure if you asked any scientists at the EPA, they've probably got reasons why they think the new data set is more accurate than the old data set.
It's also just conveniently perfectly matching with the narrative that they're trying to create.
Right, but when you look at what they've done, like I said, with the fire agency and other things, you could definitely see that there's like a very deliberate government effort to delete any data that would throw a monkey wrench in their carbon dioxide causes global warming narrative. It reminds me, we've got an article we can probably put in the show notes that I wrote a few years back called Greenhouse Apocalypse that talks about some other examples of scientific fraud that it talks about a similar thing that it looks like what happened with the EPA where the famous climate scientist, I think it was Michael Mann, where he had all the climate data, like ice core data, tree ring data, showed that there was a several centuries long period called the medieval warm period, where it was during the Middle Ages, where the global temperatures were warmer than they were today. And he designed a climate model where the computer, like, it almost looks like it deliberately did it, just deleted that warm period to create what they call the hockey stick graph, where they're like, okay, well, here's the world's temperature for the past 1,000 years, and it's like low, 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 until it gets to the point where we start burning fossil fuels and then it spiked up. Mm-hmm. Where the graph before that showed it was actually really warm when the Vikings were sailing the North Atlantic, mm-hmm. then got cold for a while, and then got back, once humans started burning fossil fuels, got back up to about the Viking levels, which raised the question. You're like, if you don't see that, you're like, well, maybe the fossil fuels is what's causing the warming. But when you see the whole thing, you're like, well, Leif Erikson didn't burn fossil fuels. He rode his own boat. So it's...
Right. The Vikings weren't known for their extravagant oil production.
Yeah.
Well, it's very difficult to come to a knowledge of the truth when you have this kind of deliberate obfuscation taking place on the part of the people who are supposed to be presenting the facts, when they're so agenda driven, and they're the ones that are spending the money. They're the ones that are making the policy decisions. They're the ones that are shutting down the coal plants. They're the ones that are pouring resources into green energy production. It's not a fair fight.
Yeah, absolutely not.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the Environmental Protection Agency manipulating data to suit its climate change narrative. He has an article about this that you can read at thetrumpet.com. Federal agency deletes data to make it seem global warming causes wildfires. And we have a couple of other articles that we will link to in the show notes for today's program that are related to that as well, including the greenhouse apocalypse that he referenced. We also have an article called The Unseen Consequence of Climate Change that presents some of the graphs that were manipulated. This is from about 18 months ago, and we'll link to that so you can see some of those graphs yourself. Thanks so much. Great to have you on, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
The Kennecott Copper Smelter is on the south side of the Great Salt Lake in Utah in the United States. It's one of the largest copper mining operations in the world. It has the second tallest smokestack in the U.S. It's just 35 feet shorter than the Empire State Building. Right behind this smelter is the Ochre Mountains. These were once the home of lush forests. Naturalist John Muir once wrote, "Looking to the gray, sagey slopes from the base of the Ochre Mountains, covered with a thick plush cloth of gold, soft and ethereal as a cloud, surely nothing in heaven nor any mansion of the Lord in all his worlds could be more gloriously carpeted." But this copper mine operation decimated that beautiful forest. One day in about 1940, a young boy watched as a torrential river ran behind his home, full of mud, boulders, and debris running off the mountainside that had no plants to protect the soil. His name was Paul Rokich. He said, "When I was 6 years old, I vowed that someday I would fix those mountains and I would help restore what had been lost from mining, smelting, logging, and overgrazing." He wasn't able to do much for many years. His father died, his brothers went off to war, he had to support his family, and then he did his time in the army. After he returned home, he went to the smelter office and he asked if they planned to bring the trees back, and they said no. he asked if they'd let him try to bring them back, and they said no. Well, he went to the University of Utah to major in botany. He told an ecology professor about his plan, and he was told that that area was beyond hope. Because of high winds and no animals to spread seeds, trees just wouldn't grow there. He was told it would take 20,000 years to revegetate that 6-square-mile piece of earth. Botanists at the university told him that he was crazy. He said, "They told me it couldn't be done. The land was too eroded, beyond hope for reclamation. I set out to prove them wrong." One day in 1957, Paul decided it was time to act. The land was owned by the mine, so in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness, he set out in Black Rock Canyon with a backpack full of trees and seeds. For 7 hours, he planted them wherever he thought they would take hold. A week later, he did it again. And he started to do this regularly. There were no roads where he wanted to go, so he would hike to the top and plant as he went, secretly, stealthily. He kept planting more and more. He collected seeds from many trees, acorns, maple seeds. He spent his own money to buy seeds and seedlings. And sometimes people would give him plants. In grassy areas, he planted sweet clover, alfalfa, wheatgrass, and wildflowers. In shrub areas, he planted cliff rose, bitterbrush, sagebrush, birch, curl-leaf mountain mahogany. He planted aspens, poplars, oaks, and willows. And guess what? Paul Rokitch did prove them wrong. The Black Rock Canyon today is a flourishing forest. Now, for 14 years, Paul told very few people about what he was doing. In 1973, Paul finally confessed. He took some mining officials on a field trip to show them what he had done. But instead of having him arrested, they hired him to work full-time rehabilitating the 70,000 acres of the barren, long-abused mountain. They began providing crews to help him with tractors and drills and helicopters and planes. Paul Rokitch became known as the man who plants the trees, the Johnny Appleseed of the Okurs. Over his career, he planted 60,000 trees and 20,000 acres of grass. This was the work of one determined man. He was able to turn an area that looked like a lunar landscape into a vibrant ecosystem. There is a very inspiring passage of prophecy in Isaiah 55. It begins in verse 7. It says, "Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Eternal, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Then it says, "For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and returns not there, but waters the earth and makes it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it." So when God says something, it happens. And the analogy that he uses to illustrate this is so fitting, because it is also God who gives the rain and the snow and causes plants to grow. And the context here is the kind of transformation that this earth is going to witness very soon when God's kingdom is established on earth in what the Bible calls the millennium. Verse 12 here says, "For you shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth before you into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree, and it shall be to the eternal for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off." This prophecy is going to be fulfilled in the millennium. And that last verse there, verse 13, is referencing the curse on the land that was described in Genesis 3, where God introduced thorns and briars. It says that that curse on the land is going to be eliminated. So there will be a revolution that will make it far easier to make things grow. It'll be far easier to revegetate and rehabilitate land such as that which Paul Rokitch was working on. He did his work restoring that habitat even when this curse was still on the land. And when he did that, animals returned to the area. Today, that area is full of birds and eagles and rabbits, foxes, deer, coyotes, bobcats. So many elk came in that some of them were transplanted to start herds elsewhere. Paul said, "I am the luckiest man alive. Throw $1 million in the road and I wouldn't take it. I love what I do here and feel that what I do here is what I am supposed to do." In his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, said, "Men and women will get down on their knees and plant roses. They will make this earth beautiful. Mankind will see what they can accomplish when their energy has a godly focus." There are so many prophecies that describe what this world is going to be like. And soon, the inhabitants of this earth are going to be able to focus on dressing and keeping this earth and causing it to become like the garden of God. Mr. Fleury wrote this, "What a magnificent change this earth will experience. The earth is about to burst forth in joy and singing. People will be singing vigorously all over the world because they're so filled with joy. What a miraculous change from today's world." I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Josue Michels, Rufato Manyepa, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Napoleon: "Space we can recover, time never. I may lose a battle, but I shall never lose a minute." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.